When was the last time that you did psychedelics?
Well, about 3 years ago, sadly, it's been a huge drought of availability since I moved from the States to New Zealand. I was just
I wouldn't be
cultivating.
so sad about it if I were you. So it's
It's
reminding me, I mean, just hearing this
yeah.
latest account, it's reminding me of what a relief it was for me to swear off psychedelics because of how much pressure I put myself under through psychedelic use. Like with the kind of questions that you're describing, that kind of struggle, that's not something that we're, I mean, I don't know how to put it. Like,
Equipped to figure out even.
no, the mind can't deal with
Yeah.
these kind of questions. It wasn't built to deal with them. It was built to keep them at bay. So then we get
Yeah.
trapped by that defense system of the mind that, kept the trauma out of awareness. And then because we feel trapped, we do psychedelics to get out of it. And psychedelics is re-traumatization in some sense, I think. And that's, why there's so much distress around it, distress and stress in general.
Around the use of psychedelics, particularly, you mean? Well, that definitely would fit in with sort of Jan Irving's research and intelligence agencies propagating their usage and that whole sort of line of thinking. But yeah, that's true. I certainly don't disagree with that. That also, there's also huge periods of just sort of bliss and quietness and just
Well,
ultimate
sure. I've obviously
presence
got to
in the
have the,
moment.
you got to have the, some sort of lure, otherwise no one's going to do it. It's just distressing. Absolutely. And I did them despite the fear involved, but I also saw the fear and the anxiety as a challenge. Like, I'm heroic. I'm going to face these fears.
But
And
you've
then, I got the bliss as a reward for facing my fears, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't see it that way now. I don't think that.
You feel the downside outweighs the upside of engaging with them in general?
In general, I definitely feel that. For me personally, I would. It's really tricky because I'm pretty much. Well, where I am now, and I look back on my life so far as I do, I don't really do that. But, and if I were to do it, I think I would say, well, that it was a pretty rich journey that I've been on, and I got it all wrong, but it still got me to where I am now, which is where I can see how wrong I got it, and how subtle it is, and how little it takes to get it right. Like, I thought I had to do so much. The psychedelics and the rituals and the knowledge and the spiritual questing and the asceticism and you name it, all of that stuff felt like I had to do it. I did often it felt like that on an intense psychedelic trip that the whole of existence was hinging on my own performance. And that's a common psychosis, right?
I'll be dishonest if I said I never felt sort of, those sort of delusions of grandeur from time to time on psychedelics. But I guess the one I felt more was just that, not so much that I needed to or had to, but that to live a worthwhile or valuable life, you had to. Yes, it was, I guess it could be the, a similar side to it, but it wasn't like I was destined or I had to. But it was like, well, if you want to do something really great or worthwhile, that's the scale you need to achieve on. You got to completely change, how the world works, and you have to restore happiness and peace to it, not because you're destined or special, but just that's, if you want to do something worthwhile, then
And
that's the
what would
scale.
be the what was the incentive there?
That's a good question.
'Cause it seemed to me that the grander the vision, the grander the motivational factors have to be, including negative motivational. And so basically you go to heaven
Ego.
if you succeed, and if you don't, well, you don't get to go to heaven, kind of thing.
I mean, I never had any religious framework growing up, or so it wasn't that, but I'm sure there was some sort of equivalent psychological mechanism driving it, you know, just to be a good person or to do something good, you know, you had to achieve something great on that scale.
I presume that this wasn't something that you were ambivalent about at the time, though. Like, well, I could live a worthwhile life, or I could just... Right? There must have been some urgency there and intensity as well.
Yeah, well, I think that's how everything seems to be when you're under 20.
Well, certainly as children, I think it is. And
yeah.
I mean, and yeah, it gets translated into a sort of grand vision for one's future, I think. Did for me.
Yeah.
But I think for young children, it is more a question of, will I survive the next few minutes or hours or days within this environment in which I don't know what the right thing to do is, and I don't know how to get taken care of, whatever it is. I mean, it's very subjective or individual. Mm-hmm. The circumstances that we're navigating as children, in which our survival is actually at stake and does appear to depend on what we do. Like, if we do the wrong thing, we get punished or neglected or ignored.
Yeah.
Even if there isn't a correlation, we may well make a correlation.
Well, in the past, there would have been a correlation. You know, in earlier human history, or even not that far ago, you know, many children did die or get horribly mistreated, or you know what I mean, or
they
starve to death,
did, yeah.
Or yeah. So there must be some sort of resonance of that carries on.
Well, also, I mean, psychic annihilation for a child,
mm-hmm.
Before we've actually even formed an identity that can be annihilated. So it's very hard to talk about what that would be. But
yeah.
But still, I mean, if very small children aren't, I won't even say cared for, because I think that even if they're treated brutally, this can at least help them to have a sense that they exist. But I think there's an early formative stage where we're not fully landed in the body, and we're not fully kind of anchored in existence, where we can just, I don't know if choose to die is the word, or if just what happens. But I think that certainly as young children, if the circumstances are sufficiently harmful or negative, then we can actually physically die without actually being murdered, if you see what I mean. So
as in, you're saying in physical actuality die, but not
due to being physically
killed.
But for psychic reasons,
basically disconnect, the cord is not, the bond is not created. And there's certainly tons of historical, what's the right term, myths or folklore about that being true for children.
Yeah.
You know, everyone, different cultures have these different time frames of, you know, where it takes the soul, you know, X days to, you know, incarnate or embody, and before that it's partially here, and this is a crucial phase, you know, this Tibetan lengths and Amazonian lengths, you know, seems to be something that people are aware of, this... that it is.
And there's crib death as well. Huh? It was very common in the 70s.
Sudden infant death syndrome or something.
Yeah, that thing.
Shocking sounding.
Yeah. So anyway, just as a... like, I, as you probably know, if you've listened to enough of me talking, I do like to try and find templates in the formative experiences of the psyche that correlate with these grand psychedelic visions, because the tendency when we're on them, and even afterwards, if we read the right books, is to project them the other way into the future and say, well, this is actually me remembering that I'm God, and so on.
You know? Yeah.
Those kind of interpretations. And although there may be truth in them, I think it... if there's a corresponding template in our past, in our childhood, then that cosmic truth is at best only half truth. You know? And it may be that you don't need the other one if you really If you find a perfect match in our infinite experiences, then we don't need to the other one to kind of buffer ourselves from this horrendous experience in the past that we're trying to get back to, ironically, because bring it back to the linear time and depression and all the futility and all those things. Well, as children, we weren't locked into that pattern. We didn't have routines. We didn't have a sense of futility. We didn't have a sense of linear time, even.
Yeah.
So that's the lost state of innocence, so-called. But it wasn't lost. It was torn from us by Saturnian parenting, I guess, way or another.
Do you think that in some sort of ideal state, you could just not end that timeless state as a child? Like, if there was the right physical and social setting, that would be possible to just live out a biological life and never end that period?
I don't know, but it seems as though with the optimal experience is both, isn't it? Is to have a sense of a self existing in linear time, while also having a deeper, wider sense containing that, that kind of seed of individuality of being outside the temporal frame of experience.
Because the temporal frame allows sort of the joy of that,
of the other. Otherwise you end up like Whitley's and Alan Watts's God, who's screaming like a madman inside the cage of infinity or whatever it is, like, oh my God, I've got to forget I'm God. I'm all alone here or something. I mean, I totally relate to these interpretations because I've had them. But what I'm experiencing more now that I'm, left all of that psychedelic gung-ho seeking behind, is bodily. It's a sensation, so there doesn't seem to be an issue about, like, if I were to drop into that sensation all the way and that was eternity, it doesn't seem that there would be an issue of, oh my God, it'll always be the same, because it's just constantly regenerating itself. It's always new, the sensation, somehow. And maybe that's actually true. Think about it. Like, if we think, our thoughts get old very fast, and yet we cling to them, and basically we think the same thoughts for decades on end. I know I'm still thinking some of the same thoughts I was thinking when I was 20.
Yeah.
But a sensation is never the same. It's always, there's always a newness to it.
Well, when you come back to a sensation, even if that sort of external thing is the same, I think usually internally you've experienced different things since then. You know, like, it's even if it's just one millisecond, something else has happened to you, to your experience. So now you're different when you encounter this thing again. So it's always
that's like time as well. Because if we're just in the linear time where we're just, it's kind of stuck in the present. It's kind of irony that we're supposed to be living in the present, but I mean, we're always, it's all, the present moment is always the same, right? Because we've still got that nag saying, I've got to get to the next moment because it'll be better than this one. That's basically what the nag says, right? Is the future is going to be better. I've got to get there. But what you're describing there, how I was getting it, was that time is, although it's linear, it's also, I can't think of another word for it, but it's like a sphere in that it's expanding outward in every direction. So, like when I was a child, I don't remember my childhood, but I do have a sense, actually, and I got this from marijuana, so maybe this is an example of a productive
useful
use of
use,
psychedelic,
yeah.
If it's accurate, because with a pinch of salt. But I had a sense then of how I experienced as a child, how I experienced time was that every moment continued. It didn't go away. So my experience of myself was growing. as a child, in that I lived one moment and then that moment continued, but then there was another moment came, and so the previous moment was still happening, but then this next moment was also happening, and then so all, more and more moments were happening simultaneously.
Interesting. Wow, that's Well, I mean, I think sounds weird, but I mean, I think logically that's really the most sensible way to look at time. I mean, the idea that there is only present, but then that's gone as soon as you're not. I mean, I had a weird epiphany driving to work one day about how time functioned. And it's funny that you said an expanding cloud and that the moment started there, because it was exactly what was sort of downloaded, or what I thought of was that time wasn't something that sort of proceeded or flowed like a river, but there was basically an infinite cloud of possibilities. Every single possible thing that could happen in every combination is there because it's infinite, and that consciousness sort of like traced a pathway through the dots as a story, and that gave the sense that time was flowing. But all those dots, all those moments, they didn't move. They were infinite in this sort of cloud, and it was just sort of where the light of consciousness was moving between. And that I get this sort of a similar way of describing what you said.
Well,
Those
that
moments
it's
all
very
stay
similar
there.
to it's very similar to how Neil Cramer described it, I think, on that stormy weather thing. He talked about a laser that intersects with matter, or I can't
Yes.
remember. Anyway, it was
It sounds
similar to
familiar.
what you said. I think that that's it may well be accurate, but that is again, more of a psychedelic view where we are consciousness experiencing the infinite possibilities of consciousness. Well, yes, but we're also incarnate in this body. And I mean, I used to believe that enlightenment was that, what you just described, like becoming conscious of everything that ever happened, ever will happen, or that is happening now in the universe simultaneously. That was it. That's what enlightenment is. Well, I think that, I mean, that's what the universe is. So I don't see why we as individuals would need to actually be that, because that's happening already, right?
That's already
So
a
then
thing, so it's not
that's
fruitful for
already a
you
thing.
to try to do.
No, and it would just be complete madness. I mean, how would one even be able to, put a coin in the parking meter if we were spread out across the universe, sort of thing? But
It's
there
like,
does seem to be an interim between those, which is you don't have to become the universe to become whole, but you can slip out the sort of gateless or the open cage of the mind and experience the body's experience of time, which is all these. I mean, I'm 49, so how many moments? I mean, they're not really actual particles of time, are they? A moment, but whatever we're talking about here,
Yeah, but
how
we
much
don't
is
know.
happening? How much really is happening in my unconscious that has been happening since I was born? That's all still happening. This conversation has that sort of tidal wave or that backlog of experience behind it. And potentially, it could just break through the dam of the mind, and all of that experience could land here, and that would be enlightenment, I think. It would be the psyche being fully aligned with the body, so that the unconscious is conscious, and then this life and this identity is the totality of my experience on this earth, essentially, which would be the dreams and everything, and it would all be happening simultaneously. And I mean, it does seem reasonable. Again, I don't know if it would be a mind thing though, because I think there's one of those paradoxes is that's only possible when the mind is not dominant, when the mind isn't there, flattening everything out and passing everything out, so that it has this that reducing valve that Huxley talks about, but of course we don't want to quote Huxley. But anyway, it's like the meat grinder that squishes it all into that one sausage.
The mind
And then we.
seems like it's sort of only useful as a party trick or entertainment, but this doesn't seem to provide long-lasting value. And you used to always sort of dichotomize things between you have a knowing of something, or I guess a belief or a thinking, but there was this distinction of a knowing that was not...
A knowing was, yeah, in the present, and there's a bodily sense of something.
And it wasn't contingent on anything. It's sort of, in a way, it's also sort of outside of time, isn't it? Because it's not that it can come in, or it's just like, yep, there's a knowing of this. It's not like I figured it out. So it's almost like it's not outside the time. I mean, even though you could look at your life and I didn't have a knowing, maybe you could say you didn't have a knowing of it, but it is almost sort of outside of time. It's just, yes, I have a knowing of this. I'm not sure if I can say it started this time or from those causes. But yeah, I guess it was like you're saying, it's useful to have that perspective, the cosmic perspective. Even though I think ultimately, if you think there's any reason or to being here, well, we are here, right? So if there's any reason to it, then there's a reason that we're experiencing this. So to try and flee from it back to the cosmic immediately, you know, you might just get out of it and be like, well, that was silly, you know? Why?
Well, that's an interesting choice of words, though, to flee from the mundane or whatever we want to call that experience to the cosmic, because, of course, the cosmic would contain and include the thing that we are fleeing from. So if we really were entering into the cosmic, we wouldn't be escaping anything.
You're just expanding the scale, but it's still
you change the perspective and the emphasis. So one's paltry personal sufferings seems like they would get diluted into this huge template or this tapestry of, but of course there's all kinds of other suffering and pain going on elsewhere, so it seems that it would only magnify. Like if we were to,
if you had an awareness,
if we were to take the part of us that wants to flee pain into the cosmic, then we would just magnify the very thing we're trying to flee, I think.
Yeah, it certainly wouldn't change that root thing that's occurring. It would just change the scale of it.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, I mean, maybe that's part of, or large part of, why I try and focus on the past trauma, because it's what's motivating us to access whatever it is, experience, is going to determine the experience itself and what we do with it. So, and this seems to be, it seems like to many people that's a very subtle distinction that I haven't succeeded in communicating that well, maybe because I don't understand it well enough. But like I was thinking with Jeffrey Kripal and the Prisoner Infinity thing, that I was that trying to kind of zero in on that distinction between acknowledging a side of us that exists and not denying it, you know, and insisting on a more narrow view of things, and actually actively seeking it and trying to create it or generate it or control it. So to me, it's not subtle at all, but it seems that it is to many others, because I feel as though sometimes my arguments don't get across. So so if, like, what's the difference between enlightenment that I'm actually not sure how to finish this sentence, actually, or I probably shouldn't have even started it. Do you want to say something?
Sure.
Makes men go crazy when a woman wears a dress so tight. What makes a man go crazy? when a woman wears a dress so tight. Must be the same old scene that makes the tomcat fight all night. Now I do hope big men try to run a big leg woman down. Now I do hope big men try to run a big leg woman down. Must be the same old thing that makes the bulldog ugly round. The same thing.
It's the same thing.
Yes, it's the same thing.
It's the same thing.
That's the same thing.
Just the same thing.
Well, it's the same thing.
The same thing.
Tell me who's to blame. The whole world is fighting for that. Is fighting for that. Is fighting for that.
Just discussing enlightenment in general is such that term is so hard to even use in a discussion, isn't it? It's because it's, or at least for me, I'm not even sure when as soon as I drill into what is enlightenment, that anything substance it has seems, even in that question, seems to disappear. Like it's almost like not even a question. Right. Does that make sense? I don't, it's such a strange term or concept of becoming enlightened. I mean, I know what the sort of cultural stereotype of that
okay,
is.
Okay, so, but the meaning that it has, we can come up with many different synonyms now for wholeness or completeness or self-realization, or, but essentially, you know, anyone who's in the field of metaphysics or the paranormal and is trying to get to the bottom of things,
yeah,
that's really what they're talking about one way or
seeking
another.
Enlightenment.
Yeah,
they're seeking wholeness or just contentness with themselves and where they are.
Well, of course, everybody's seeking happiness, but I mean, once you've become a quester after truth of one form or another,
then you're in the next level, which is enlightenment.
Yeah, you're seeking the answer to the riddle of human consciousness, let's say. So the point that I've got stuck on trying to make was to do with the motivation, you know, what motivates us to seek wholeness or to seek a full understanding of our experience, you know, as individuals. And Kripal's thing is that trauma can somehow open us up to an experience of that completeness, which may I think is true in the terms that he's talking about it. But and so I wasn't questioning that. What I was questioning was is that if trauma, if your introduction to the that sense of our deeper potential is through trauma, the motivation also to experience it is going to be shaped by trauma as well. So yeah, what motivates us to want to have a deeper experience of ourselves, to want to take psychedelics, to want to learn tantra, tantric sex, to want to become a yogi meister, to want to be enlightened, you know, want to be a super shaman, etc., etc. What's motivating it? If it's the motivation is sourced in trauma, unconscious trauma, then the motivation isn't really going to be for wholeness. It's going to be for power, to want to become powerful.
Sure. And is there another path to introduce that that's not trauma that you've come across? I mean, is it all predicated on trauma? All of us that are looking for this thing?
It seems to me. I mean, but I don't know. I
mean, so maybe.
And I don't know if that, I think even if it is, that doesn't mean that, like I said, in my case, realizing that I was getting it wrong for so long, and I may look back on now and say the same, I don't know, but that at least opens the possibility of, okay, I can still put my attention on, well, it's like changing where my attention is. So instead of putting my attention on the thing I want to get, I'm putting my attention on the part of me that wants to get it, and on the source of that drive to get it. And that's the trauma, and that conversely, ironically or whatever, seems to be working more, in that part's getting healed because it's getting attention. It's actually getting the care that it needed, and so it's becoming less and less needful of power.
Yeah. So as you heal the trauma, you sort of lessen that desire or need to discover cosmic truth.
Yeah, and that seems to be the cosmic truth. That's the discovery.
But that is the cosmic truth.
We don't need to discover it because we are it.
Yeah.
So we can be discovered. It's like, it's more of an experience of being discovered, or
or
of something that's always been signaling us, but we've just been putting our attention on the noise, and so we didn't hear the signal, but it's actually always been there.
Yeah, which sort of, I vaguely sort of may have attempted to convey this, but I've gotten that sense from sort of your work, and then it puts you in this state where you're almost seeking your trauma, and it makes you cautious or nervous that you don't invent anything to heal, to progress. You know what I mean? It's like, well,
inventing trauma.
Yeah, well, it's like, well, you know, I'm really looking for, you know, I'm a seeker. Okay, I take all those boxes. So where's my trauma? There must be some huge trauma, you know.
Mm-hmm. So that's what's been happening with you.
Well, it's something that your work has brought up, has made me consider. Okay, well, where, you know, well, I seem to tick these boxes. So where, you know, where is my trauma located?
Okay, so let's just stay on that for a second. What does that mean? Where is it located?
Oh, sorry. What has happened in my life?
Where is in the past?
Because it could mean where
in your body would be another.
That would be sort of maybe something to resolve once you actually figure out what caused it. I guess what I'm saying is, have I had serious trauma in my life, especially as a child, and what was that, if any? And I guess nothing out of the ordinary seems to show up, which makes me
Well, how long have you been entertaining that possibility?
It's hard to not entertain it, you know, listening.
Seriously entertaining it, then?
Couple of years, maybe.
Okay, so yeah. It's not very long, then.
No.
No, if how old are you?
33.
Oh, that's a timely age for exploring trauma.
Yeah.
So then, if we're talking about something that you may have buried in your consciousness for 30 years,
yeah,
then a couple of years isn't that long to start looking.
Sure, and I guess I do remember tons of trauma, and I actually remember quite a bit of my childhood, but I mean, in the sense that I don't have any memories of being raped or beaten or these classic serious ones, mm-hmm. I don't have any memory of, and it's almost like because so many people that you speak to are just people in general in this field, and it's so much child abuse is revealed, it's almost like, you know, well, you know, am I missing out on, you know, it's like this weird thing where you feel like, well, you know, is that if I don't remember it? But yeah, that's sort of the only thing I was getting at. It's like almost a weird tendency to put something in there, but it's not that I don't remember being severely traumatized when I had to be dropped off for kindergarten the first time and trying to, you know, open the door and get back to my mom and, you know, really traumatic stuff, or just integrating with other kids and, you know, just being a weirdo and having, you know, so it's not like that was basically my whole experience in school was severely traumatic, you know, even I remember as a preschooler or first grader just saying like, no, this is terrible, this is the worst thing ever. You know, I can't stand it, and constant. But so, it's not that I'm in denial that I haven't constantly had traumas, but there's none of these sort of iconic big T traumas that I have memory of, if that makes sense.
Well, would you expect to have memory of them if they were there?
It's a good question, isn't it? I mean, is it? I guess it is common for people to completely suppress that memory, but it's really hard to know how that would transpire in someone else's mind. I think that would be something that's really hard to understand exactly how those memories are blocked.
Well, it is hard to understand. It's hard to talk about, and I think largely because the way that our mind is configured by trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Is in such a way that it wouldn't work if we were to forget something and still remember that we'd forgotten it. We have to forget and forget that we've forgotten.
Otherwise,
and
it's so, not a shield, yeah.
Yeah, and so that also wouldn't work if we forgot and forgot that we'd forgotten, but we could somehow sense that the memory mind identity that we had was incomplete. Well, because we can somehow sense it, that's what makes us spiritual seekers. But I mean, if we could sense it in a more literal way of, oh my god, I've blocked something from my awareness kind of way, then that also would signal us where the trauma was. So it has to work in such a way of papering over the cracks. And this is very eerie. I mean, I tried to explore this in this novel that I've just written. What would it be like to be an MKUltra victim who was literally fragmented and had various different identities that were constantly taking over?
Yeah.
You know, how could somebody who was a victim of that, how could they possibly think that they were all there? How could they possibly believe that they were living a full life, you know? Because it seems as though it would be so obvious if you had missing time experiences and so on, but clearly if it works, it's not, right? So then if that's the case, how does any of us know? How do we know that we haven't been...
MKO.
That we haven't... Well, certainly that, but specifically how do we know that on any given day that we haven't done things and then completely forgotten, and then forgotten that we've forgotten, and somehow sort of reconfigured our memory in such a way that we don't see holes.
Yeah.
Like, it's a big mystery.
Yeah. But, and you see what I'm saying, that then you run the risk of, if you realize what we just said, and then you're looking back, you have to be really careful that you don't construct memories in your search for authentic memories. I guess that's what I was trying to say.
I haven't had the problem. I mean, I'm aware of, because I haven't had any memories come out that I had to think, well, maybe did I construct that?
Yeah.
I mean, I've had dreams, but then they're dreams, so of course I'm like, well, I don't know if that's real or not.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly am aware of, well, am I arranging the data in such a way that convinces me something must have happened in my past when it didn't?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, for example, in my preschool, we had, there was like a, you know, a two-way, there was a room there and there was a two-way mirror or a mirror where people in the back could see out. We couldn't, and, oh yeah, these are, you know, some students and they're here studying, you know, kids, and, you know, they come in and ask you questions and do some tests, and it's like, whoa, that's, you know, if you look into any sort of MKUltra, any sort of remotely second matrixy conspiracy stuff, you go, oh, is that a screen memory? You know what I mean? Like, that would be, you could easily sort of morph that into much more, and it could have legitimately just been some education students at the university studying kids in preschool. You know what I mean? That's most likely what it was.
Well, maybe, but I mean, this is again where one can join dots prematurely, but on the other hand, one can be too cautious because, and this is with Occult Yorkshire, I mean, there were the two threads. One was researching what's been going on historically, and the other was looking into my own family history. And so, you know, if we find more and more evidence that these programs and these, you know, acts and these perpetrators and were proliferating throughout the culture that we grew up in, if we find that out to our satisfaction, and then we look at our own past and we go, oh, well, was that was a bit weird, this was a bit weird, it's not illogical to connect the two, because I mean, if it's far more common than we imagine, then and yet nobody's talking about it and most of us aren't even aware of it, then any little clue becomes significant, right? Any anomaly, I should say, anything that's anomalous becomes significant. I mean, I remembered the progressive school I went to getting up in the middle of the night and running around with sheets over my head for years. I mean, I never forgot that, but it was only in the last few years that I sincerely started to think, well, that, it's not a smoking gun, but it's definitely you know, a bit of gunpowder on somebody's finger or something. It's, that's got to be significant in the context of all the other stuff I found. There's got to be, that's got to indicate something. I mean, not 100%, but enough where I go, okay, so something was going on at that school.
Yeah.
Right. But I'll just backtrack a bit to something you said earlier, that you were saying it would be more logical to look for things in your past before you look for it in your body. Mm-hmm. I would say that is better to be inverted, that for me at least, I was finding it in my body before I was finding it in my past.
Yeah.
Because that's where the memories are in your body. They're not in the past.
Yeah, that's true. That's where your access to that event is.
Yeah, and the most compelling evidence to me has always been the condition of my own psyche. Like, I know what kind of neurotic patterns and drives I have, the sort of installed in my consciousness. It's just that for decades I thought that I was just fucked up. There was something weird and just anomalous about me.
Yeah.
That was all got mixed up with me being an alien or me being this or me being that. When I started to put that in the context of, well, maybe something was done to me, it really started to make sense. Like, oh, well, no wonder I have these thoughts and these feelings and these neuroses and this anxiety. And so all of that, that's the real body of evidence.
And do you feel like you have figured out what did happen to you?
No, no, not even close. Yeah. I mean,
close
unraveling. Compared to how it was a few years ago, I feel like I got a lot closer, but I'm still, I mean, Occult Yorkshire got, ironically, I couldn't actually publicise the smoking gun, but I did, hearing this for the first time now, I did hear from a family member that a member of Pi hung out with my grandfather in the house that he lived, that I used to visit. So my family was connected to Pi. I absolutely confirmed that in a way that I couldn't go public with. But you know, that's not really a smoking gun in the sense of something happened to me and I can place the face and the name and who it was and when. It's a long way from that.
Yep.
It's just completely confirmed that the environment I grew up in, I was surrounded by predators, and that I was completely on the right track. And so, you know, it's a very intuitive thing. Like if you intuit and you guess, and then you find out you were really close to hitting the mark, then that suggests that you're probably right in the other intuitions and the other guesses. And but it isn't about naming the names and ticking the boxes. It's about something like creating a climate for the conscious mind in which it's okay to re-experience the trauma bodily.
Mm. Yeah.
It's like the mind will allow it, because it's, on the one hand, it's kept busy with stuff that distracts it, but on the other hand, the stuff that's distracting it is also leading it to say, holy shit, yeah, okay, I did create this cover story to protect you from this, so okay, mm-hmm. I will release my grip a little bit. The guardian is like, okay, it's becoming less and less necessary, and but incrementally, so it's not fighting, because the guardian wants to keep control, right? So it has to be kind of gradually tutored or re-educated into relinquishing.
Turns my mistress harsh and gentle, wrapped in unfamiliar mantle, trapped by all she cannot see, beneath the grey forbidding sky. By choice my mistress for a song will sell her secrets to the one who bids the best but not the highest. Burning bridges in the forest bring my mistress poison ivy. She'll make from it a gravy for the evening sacrifice. Throw the plate back in your face, in your face, back in your face. By turns my mistress gentle, harsh and loving, with the simple force of one whose right is always wrong, will answer every bell you rang. By choice my mistress in the sea did cast away her jewels, so earned her keep another day. Let the leaning lesson lie. Now bring my mistress finest wine to wash her face while evening wanes. Splash on your carpet floor, break the glass and disappear. Disappear, break the glass and disappear. Disappear.
So part of it is, would part of it be to create the most comfortable, safe, day-to-day space to live in, to allow access to that?
I mean, I couldn't, there's no way that I would have done any of this without having met and married a partner who had similar experiences, similar patterns and whatnot, who was kind of the whole time saying it's okay to go here. Because my guardian was telling me, no, you're obsessive, you're compulsive, you're just fingering the wound, all the versions, it's smart enough not to say, you don't want to know, because
you,
I'm obviously going to say any of that I'm going to know is bullshit, but it knows what to say to make me doubt, which is what I just said. This is compulsive and it's not actually going to lead to any kind of healing. I constantly doubted that. Because that's the social mandate, is let the past be past. Why go back there?
Don't dredge it up.
Yes, let sleeping dogs lie.
Well, I wonder if the draw to do psychedelics is some sort of, so I guess you were saying that you felt it was just added additional trauma on top of it, but what if it does sort of stir up the pot and maybe set the scene for, in the future, a chance of accessing it, or if it isn't.
Well, it did. I mean, it seems like it did for me. Yeah. One of the things I said about psychedelics, and this correlates with the comparison you're making, mm-hmm. is that the reason they were harmful, the reason I realized they are harmful and how they were harmful to me is that one of the models is that they bring up far more material from the unconscious than we can integrate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all this unconscious matter coming up, and we're lucky if we can integrate like 1% of it.
Because
there's a reason it was unconscious. Right?
Yeah.
So if you use psychedelics to hack the psyche and release all these files, you're not going to actually have time to read them before they vaporize or crash the disk.
Yeah. Right?
So the drive there was to get to the truth in the body. So I was just listening to this interesting interview about torture and how the rationale for torture is to do with the body politic and the idea that the body is just a machine, it's not a subject, got no interiority, mm-hmm. and that if we want information, you just torture it, you just hack into it, and you physically remove the information, which of course doesn't work. Torture generally doesn't work because people will say anything to not be tortured, right? They have a subjective self that just wants to get away from the pain.
So but
this idea is very deep, that if we want to access something, we'll just use force and we'll rip it out. And so I think psychedelics is like, I don't want to meditate for 30 years, I just want to get it. Give me these drugs. And although I didn't have any childhood memories, I'd certainly accessed something that let me know that I'm vastly greater than I had experienced myself as, and that there were these hidden reserves of experience or of data or of energy, whatever we call it. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand that. Like, I understood my mind is resisting, but I didn't understand why and how the mind has been constructed through trauma as a resistance to the unconscious, and that is a necessary defense. Like, you can't just blast it off its hinges with these DMT cannons, because what will happen is it will the amnesiac tissue, or whatever we call it, will reconstitute itself and be even more impenetrable.
Yeah.
As a result. So I experienced this at a mundane level, as it was really hard to live a normal life after psychedelics, because my life's, once I did stop using them, my life became incredibly dreary, routine, depressing, just one day after the next, looking for physical pleasures to distract me from how ordinary everything was.
Yeah. And then how did you move out of that phase into one where you're glad you're not doing psychedelics? Just time.
I just stayed. Yeah, it's just seconds. Really, I just sat in it. I experienced it viscerally as like this well, like it was a well in me that was, there was no water in it, mm-hmm. but it was full of all this trash. And I was just the process of sitting there in the parched for any kind of experience was allowing the well to get cleared of all this trash I'd mm-hmm. put in it, and then eventually water would start bubbling up from the emptiness. But it was really about holding the space of emptiness and not throwing more trash in it, not putting popcorn, or I did eat popcorn, I did watch movies, and those were my vices.
Yeah.
And I really wrestled with that. Like, it was like a junkie with his heroin. Like, I knew it was self-destructive, but at the same time I was really consciously doing as little as I could without going crazy, to fill mm-hmm. the hole.
That does really seem like the only constructive way to heal, to sort of progress things. You know, there's not any doing that progresses. It's just a being with whatever this is, sadness or tragedy or lack of the excitement, or sort of, like you said, when you're experiencing constant psychedelic visions, it's very grand and epic, and then you just, if you stop, then you're just sort of overwhelmed by the mundaneness of, or that's how it's perceived. And definitely something that I've learned as you grow with experience is that it's not about doing anything to fix it or end it. It's just, this is a thing and you just have to be with it, you know. It's interesting, but that does seem to be ultimately the only way to heal, mm-hmm. to heal trauma, or heal, I guess they're all sort of flavors of trauma, aren't they? You're traumatized by the lack of excitement after.
Well, it's the traumatized self that needs the distraction, mm-hmm. I suppose, is to maintain the amnesia. I mean, because if the mind is the thing that protects us from trauma, and yet we feel trapped by it, we're sort of caught in this impossible situation, because if we let the mind dissolve, we'll be vulnerable to the trauma. Mm-hmm. But if we stay in the mind, it's incredibly restricting. So then we try and inflate the mind as much as possible. We expand the mind so that we can fit more and more stuff in there.
Yeah, yeah. And give yourself sort of a sense of worth through that, through the mind.
Being whole, like if you make the mind big enough, it feels like that's it. This is the whole of what I am. But it never will be, because the body is really where it's at, and it does, like the body, and we're talking about psyche as well, like two, there's this twin system, but both, I think, they regenerate naturally. They just naturally regenerate themselves, as long as you stop doing the thing to them that's causing the damage.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's a sort of a set rate of regeneration, and if you are exceeding that rate with damage or trauma, then you'll degrade the state of the system. But even if it's not zero trauma or zero distraction, if it's under that sort of regeneration threshold, then the system heals or becomes more whole at that rate of difference.
I
definitely do share that sense that there is sort of a continual regeneration of it, that there is some sort of innate positive movement of those systems, which is
it's the very inverse of that. The distress that I described for myself under psychedelics was that I had to do so much to actually become whole, or whatever it was in my mental framework at that time. The task that I set for myself, you know, was crippling.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, so it's the very inverse of all you have to do is nothing.
Yeah.
The hardest thing of all, of course, but it's not a task. It's a willingness, I guess, not to live the dream.
Yeah. It's so hard to use language for it, but it's not. It comes a little bit back to the time thing of, it's not like if there isn't really much, if there's no reality of sort of this linear time experience, then truly changing anything, you know, a psyche, a soul, whatever, wouldn't be a matter of doing anything in linear time. It would have to be things which are outside of that.
The part of us that's really experiencing is the eternal part, and then that's the part that can't be changed by any of what it's experiencing. How's that for paradox?
But if this sort of psyche, or the infinite portion, if it can change its outlook or sort of shift its perception, that's it's hard to sort of draw these lines on these subjects, but it's like almost, well, it's not about accomplishing anything in linear time, but it's about changing something outside of linear time, which is more your accepting it or being with it, you know?
But isn't it a contradiction to put change side by side with outside time?
It is. It's a huge contradiction, which it seems to be. If there is one sort of one thread connecting my personal investigations, is that generally things that seem paradoxical are where the fruit is. You know what I mean?
This seems to be true.
Yeah. It's like whenever you...
So, but then there's two parts of us. It's back to that, right?
Yeah.
So there's the part that is outside time, which can't ever change and doesn't need to do anything. And yet that's the only part that can do anything. And then there's the part that really needs to change, and which is basically dependent on time to even exist.
Yeah.
And all that gets to do is, what? Nothing.
Yeah. But is it, I mean, it makes some sense, but does it hold up that you need time, as we view it, to change, to have change? Like, can the infinite never change? Because I'm not sure that that's...
I don't see how the infinite could change, because how would it become... It would have to become less or more than infinite, and there is no such
thing.
It's just
infinite.
It's, infinite isn't a number, so...
Yeah.
So, and it doesn't need to change if it's infinite, because there's infinite variety already, so...
Yeah, you can't... You couldn't really say you could change the character or the tone or the flavor of infinity, because it should contain all of those flavors and tones.
All the point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting paradox. I mean, I think that paradoxes are often resolved with expanded perspective in a way, so it's some of these things you sort of hang here, you have to go,
isn't it the ring pass knot of thought, right? Once you get to the point that thought can't pass, you either back away, as most of us do, or you keep going, and then you experience the infinite, but you can't write home about it.
Yeah, I think largely that is what happened.
And I did. I mean, I experienced the infinite, and I tried to write home about it, and so, of course, I... Whatever that is, you know, that was... I became a prisoner of it. Ta-da!
That's all back to the prisoner of infinity.
Yeah.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world came tumbling down.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey, the monkey speaks his mind. Oh, here comes the monkey. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La vie dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Sur les arbres prêts.